Hello, and welcome back to Histories of Quebec. I'm your host, Rosemary Hawson. I'm a real estate broker and history nerd from Montreal and the Eastern Townships. As some of you may know, my car was broken into a little over a week ago, and my work equipment, including my laptop, on which I had all of my podcast scripts and whatnot. I never actively save anything on OneDrive. I know. I thought I'd lost not only this particular script, with all the weeks of research that went into it, you guys, this is a doozy. But I thought I would have to re-listen to episode 3, transcribe it, and then translate it in French. This coupled with the loss of all my stuff, having to get my car window repaired, dealing with the general feelings of unease that come after something like this, left me feeling pretty overwhelmed when I thought about continuing this podcast. I thought it would take me months to get back up on the horse. I know it sounds dramatic, but I work 7 days a week and I do this with any time that I can create, which isn't always easy. And the research for this particular episode came from many sources. It was a lot. So the other day I decided to take a look at my OneDrive anyway, and bam, my entire desktop was saved, including the English script for the last episode. This one was missing like a couple of paragraphs. Wasn't a big deal. But yeah, so I am back and ready to wrap up the history of the 19th century in Griffintown, guys. So bummed. So pumped that I can sit here and do this right now. Here we go. Concerned about the general conditions in Griffintown, many members of clergy tried persuading people to leave the city as the second half of the 19th century began. Sometimes this proved to be a viable solution, and sometimes not. I'll get into it. Father Phelan, I have no idea how to pronounce P-H-E-L-A-N, Phelan, let's say Phelan. Father Phelan convinced hundreds of new arrivals to relocate to Saint-Colomban, north of Montreal, where they were met with hardships that reminded them of home. The soil was too rocky to properly cultivate anything at all, so after hitting a peak of 983 people, the parish went into decline and the children of those settlers dispersed, either seeking good jobs back in Montreal or relocating to Ontarian and American cities. On the other hand, Bishop John Sweeney of St. John aided hundreds of other Irish families in settling in the woods of rural New Brunswick. He negotiated with the government so that each family obtained a large portion of land as long as they cultivated and maintained 5 of their many acres, built a house of at least 16 square feet, and helped to build the portion of the public road that crossed the front of their plot. Not bad. The settlement was named Johnville in honor of the bishop, and it not only flourished, but was in a location so lush and idyllic that people were comparing it to Ireland before the famine. The community of around 600 were found to be thriving 5 years into the project. They'd harvested crops of potatoes, oats, and buckwheat and were grateful to put their pasts behind them. One woman, Mrs. Crehan, I'm so terrible with these Irish names, told McGuire, who wrote The Irish in America in 1868, when referring to her landlord back in Galway, quote, "You may tell him for me that I'm better off than himself and more independent in my mind, and tell him, sir, all of the harm I wish is for him to know that much," end quote. Despite this, McGuire found optimism and an immense sense of community within the ill-reputed working-class neighborhood that was Griffintown. He went as far as to say that nowhere in British North America does the Catholic Irishman feel so thoroughly at home as in Montreal, where his religion is respected and his church is surrounded with dignity and splendor. The Catholics from across the city now gathered for Sunday Mass at the beautiful St. Patrick's Church, as discussed in the last episode. That said, it was packed. In 1848, the bishop asked the Jesuits to open a temporary mission in Griffintown to accommodate some of the famine refugees. They rented a small brick building on the corner of Ottawa and Murray, which later became a grocery store, and it was so necessary that people gathered outside the crowded building to try to hear Mass from the streets. Griffintown needed another church, even though it would take the parish 40 years to pay off the $44,600 debt to the Sulpicians this would incur. And so it was that in 1851, the bishop laid the first cornerstone for Montreal's second church, built specifically for the Irish. It was built on a triangle of land near the canal. While structurally speaking, it was much humbler than St. Patrick's Basilica up on the hill and could only seat 300, so half of what the basilica could, it meant the world to residents who filed in for the first time on Friday, December 8, 1854. The church's first pastor, Michael O'Brien, hailed from County Tyrone, Ireland, where he served as a priest for 15 years before landing at St. Patrick's late 1849. If you recall when the Great Famine took place, you'll know that he served during that time, and so he understood the people of Griffintown and stepped up as one of their very own. He became known as Father of the Orphans because of his efforts placing children who had lost their parents to typhus within the homes of other Irish immigrants. He directed St. Patrick's Orphan Asylum, where said children were temporarily placed, and he worked around the clock placing them but also raising funds. He also established St. Anne's Academy, the first school for English-speaking Catholic girls in the city. We'll get more into that next episode. It opened on September 6, 1857, welcoming 125 pupils. Father O'Brien was the kind of man to rent out a brick house on St. Augustine, now Rieux, to house students when construction was delayed. Over the next three decades, the population of Griffintown went from 7,000 in 1851 to 23,003 in 1891. With this, the district became more Catholic. In 1865, there were more than 700 Catholic families in Griffintown and 432 Protestant ones. This was partially due to the fact that Protestants, who tended to be wealthier, were gradually moving up to the better neighborhoods. They started setting up churches outside Griffintown, such as St. James the Apostle at St. Catherine and Bishop, which was on the outskirts of the city at the time. The Protestant families of Griffintown attended religious services less, so some of the more well-off members of those congregations replaced some of the churches with missions to help the poor they had left behind. In their eyes, Griffintown was turning into a godless place inhabited by derelicts. By the mid-19th century, significant Irish settlements were present in the Maritimes, Quebec City, Montreal, Toronto, Hamilton, Kingston, and rural Ontario. Quebec City was the only one that had a clear Roman Catholic population, but as we just discussed, Montreal saw a mixture of Protestants and Catholics. While they didn't go to war with each other as they had for centuries in Europe, tensions were present and rising. I contemplated going deeper into the orange versus the green in this episode, but I think I'll add the topic to the random topic generator jar and dedicate a whole episode to that strife because there's enough to talk about there. I will, however, go back a few years into our Griffintown history to elaborate on one event this rivalry spawned. When we think of mass civil disorder here, many instances come to mind. The infamous Guns N' Roses and Metallica show at the stadium, Stanley Cup riots, yes, that's plural, the Maurice Richard riot, are you seeing a pattern here? But nobody ever refers to the 19th century, when we saw our fair share. In 1849, a mob attacked Parliament, which was then in Montreal, and burned it down. And in 1853, a riot broke out that, in terms of human loss, caused more damage than any other before or since. Enter Alessandro Gavazzi, a tall Italian preacher and patriot usually seen wearing a black soutane. In 1825, he started out as a Barnabite monk at Naples, but left the church within a few years. I wanted to read that as Barnabite. In 1840, having already expressed liberal views, he was removed to Rome to fill a subordinate position. Leaving his own country after the capture of Rome by the French, he carried on a vigorous campaign against priests and Jesuits in England, Scotland, and North America, partly by means of a periodical, the Gavazzi Freeword. He was essentially on a one-man crusade to rid Roman Catholics of what he referred to as the tyranny of their church. This is how, on the morning of June 9, 1853, on a hot and humid day, Alessandro Gavazzi arrived in Montreal from Quebec City. Many were understandably nervous, given that a riot had broken out just a few nights earlier during his last address. The Catholic members of his audience had been so enraged, they'd rushed the pulpit to attack him. In fact, when he and his personal assistant, Paoli, stepped off the steamer named Quebec that day, only one of them was walking as Paoli arrived by stretcher, having been badly injured in the aforementioned riot. Gavazzi himself had a bruised face, but otherwise seemed pretty relaxed, given what had just transpired. He was, in fact, so unperturbed that he had slept soundly on the voyage to Montreal while his riled-up entourage plotted violent revenge. Superintendent Lieutenant Colonel William Ermatinger. Oh, guys, these are tough. And a group of policemen escorted the two men and Gavazzi's delegate of about 50 orange men to their hotel. Meanwhile, the mayor, Charles Wilson, a lot easier to say, was double-checking the plans he had put into place for upholding public order in case trouble broke out. I'm going to say it's one thing to write this stuff, another thing to speak it. The event caused extra tension even before Alessandro had arrived. Those who had sponsored this visit had originally been granted the city's concert hall and Balsacool Market for their three scheduled public meetings. However, the Irish Roman Catholic community lobbied against the idea, which led to the mayor changing his mind. So the Protestants had to look elsewhere and ended up with the Zion Congregational Church on Beaver Hall Hill. Erected in 1832, it looked out over Haymarket Square, which is Square Victoria today, and where it stood is now a Banque Nationale. Now, Mayor Wilson originally insisted on a minimum of 50 constables standing outside the church. This number soon rose to 80, a number which would include several members of the water police. It still didn't feel like enough, and so Mayor Wilson, and here we go again, Lieutenant Colonel Ermatinger. I'm so sorry if anybody has this last name, and you can hear me butchering it. Good gosh. It still didn't feel like enough, and so Mayor Wilson and the Lieutenant Colonel went to the Quebec Gate Barracks, now at the foot of Rue Saint-Hubert, in person, to see if any garrison troop members could be spared for the latter half of the day. Word of mouth, aided by handbills, spread quickly throughout the city. Alessandro Gavazzi had arrived and would speak that very night. Discreetly positioned at the foot of Haymarket Square was an engine house. And within it were 100 members from the Cameronian, a Scottish regiment that had arrived in Montreal that very morning from 3 years in Gibraltar. Mayor Wilson had escorted them there himself, as they were unfamiliar with the city. Historian Eleanor Kite Sr. wrote, "When they reached the engine house, the Cameronians were within a stone's throw of the spot where British troops had marched into the city for the first time less than 100 years earlier. A little to the south were the ruins of the Parliament House, a silent reminder of what an angry Montreal crowd could do." To add to the air of chaos in town, many officers were at that very moment at the wharf to salute the departing previous garrison, the 20th Regiment of Foot, who had completed their 3-year tour duty of Montreal. The windows on the south side of the church had been boarded up in anticipation of problems from the Griffintown slums below the hill, although the Catholic Institute had implored its members to ignore Gavazzi beforehand, publishing the following: "Catholics of Montreal, keep the peace, and let Gavazzi say what he will. Do not disgrace yourselves by creating a disturbance for the sake of a worthless fellow. Keep quiet and take no notice of what he says. Your Protestant fellow citizens will be ashamed of their renegade friar yet. And by order of the Catholic Institute, S. O'Grady, Secretary, signed Montreal, June 9, 1853. As well-intentioned as that was, it did nothing to quell the ire caused by what Gavazzi preached. Sir James Alexander, aide-de-camp to the commander of the forces, Lieutenant General William Rowan, left the ceremonies at the wharf just after 7 and arrived at the church. Outside, he noted the presence of about 40 policemen armed only with their blue batons. In the square itself, he observed groups of displeased men who looked ready for action. A few years later, Alexander wrote, "Father Gavazzi was addressing the audience in Zion Church from the front of a temporary platform. On three sides behind him were seated about a dozen and a half gentlemen, among whom were some clergymen. Gavazzi was conspicuous by his commanding figure, long hair and black gown, with large crosses on the breast and left shoulder, as he is usually seen in pictures. He spoke in English, and it is not easy to follow him at first. He was discursive, and his accent was of course peculiar. He was calm, energetic, and violent by turns." The sound of Gavazzi's voice carried outside and was said to have been heard by a doctor who was working in his office 600 feet away. "Why are a people so favored by nature with an ardent heart and spirit? Why are they so ignorant, so coarse, so savage?" he asked his Protestant listeners. "Simply because they are subservient to their priests. The Catholic clergy prefer ignorance, grossness, and brutality in their faithful rather than the civilized enlightenment of the Protestant working class." These words, falling upon the ears of the agitated crowd outside, made tensions rise dramatically. On the one hand, you had Protestants now riled up and trying to force their way into the church, while livid Catholics egged each other on. Charles Wilson feared that the security on the premises wouldn't be enough, and so he was the one to fetch backup in the form of the aforementioned 26th Regiment Cameronians. For almost an hour, this man went on about the errors of popery, the threat posed by Roman Catholic education, and if that wasn't enough, he referred to the blessings of British rule. Where a more cautious man would have toned down the rhetoric in response to the last crowd's reaction, Gavazzi presented with his usual conviction and fervor. One of Gavazzi's escorts attempted to exit the church at around 7:30 to catch the steamer back to Quebec City, but hastily retreated after merely poking his head outside the doors. Alexander later wrote that the whole scene and appearance of the lecturer must have been startling to those with weak nerves. I also wondered at the boldness of the man and how little he seemed to regard his own life or the peril he then was in and of the dangers he had already so frequently passed. The violence started suddenly. A commotion broke out in the church and spilled out into the streets, where more than 300 people waited, tense and ready. Gavazzi kept speaking. A group of about 30 men exited the church to confront the crowd, armed with clubs, hand pistols, fowling pieces, and even one double-barreled shotgun. Shots erupted from both sides before the Protestants hastily retreated back into the church. One man, Mr. Broomer, had severely wounded his head. It was only now that Gavazzi paused, but only for a few moments, and then the mob attacked the church. Alexander left the building. Outside, the situation was deteriorating. The greatly outnumbered police had been beaten off by the rioters, leaving both Ermatinger brothers injured and bleeding profusely from the head. Only the church party was left to defend the building. The rioters were eventually pushed back to the bottom of the square where they immediately started reorganizing. It was at this moment that Alexander noted that he saw the first troops emerge from the nearby engine house where they had been hidden away waiting for a command. Two lines of 50 soldiers back to back faced both sections of rioters with approximately 50 feet between them. Most of the Catholics were at the bottom of the hill while the Protestants were to the north, clustered in and around the church, with some of them only emerging now. Gavazzi and most of his party were still safely within the church and therefore still completely unaware of what was going on outside in the sweltering heat. It was almost 8 p.m. Dusk. Someone fired shots at the soldiers, missing them by so very little. For whatever reason, this caused many of the rioters to rush the soldiers. The latter were surprised. Did the crowd not know that their weapons were already loaded? From somewhere off to the side, a sweating Mayor Wilson inaudibly read the riot act at the top of his lungs. Our sovereign lady the queen chargeth and commandeth all persons being assembled immediately to disperse themselves and peaceably to their habitation or to their lawful business upon the pains contained in the act made in the first year of King George I to prevent tumults and riotous assemblies, God save the queen. The second he was done, someone yelled, fire, fire, fire. To this day, it is uncertain who gave the order, but at the time, many suspected the obviously distressed mayor. The lower division fired first and was immediately reprimanded by Lieutenant Robert Courtley. Almost in the same instant, the division facing north also opened fire. This was followed by the ceasefire cry of the bugle. The firing stopped. The entire ordeal lasted no more than 30 seconds. Sir James Alexander witnessed the event and noted that some of those about me laughed and thought that the troops had fired blank cartridge. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case. Nearby, a young boy of 10, the son of Mr. William Hutchinson, fell over with a bullet in his leg. The limb was amputated the next day, but sadly, the boy died soon after. Silence descended on the crowd. People gathered their wits and composure and began taking stock of what had happened. They were surrounded by carnage. Accounts vary, but more than six people died that night, among them a 22-year-old coppersmith from Griffintown named James Walsh, four who succumbed to bullet wounds later on, and Michael Donnelly, who died a month later on July 11th. Another 40 or so were injured, with many of these eventually succumbing to their wounds. Alexander wrote that persons from 10 years of age to 60 suffered, including gentlemen and workpeople, with English, Scottish, and Irish names. Two ladies were wounded, and some good people, though apparently not dangerously wounded at the time, died afterwards with much suffering. One of the survivors, Mr. Hugh Mackay, went on to help establish Montreal's Mackay Center for Deaf Mutes. Quote, for deaf mutes. He was shot in the leg during the scuffle, but ultimately only bore a scar. Now, while all of this was going on, Alessandro Gavazzi was hiding in the church's basement, discussing the events with his party and, bit by bit, removing his religious garb. They heard the shots. Gavazzi's first reaction was to attempt to head outside to see what had happened and if he could be of assistance. He had, after all, been chaplain to Garibaldi's army in 1848. However, his local acquaintances blocked his path, fearing for his life. Eventually, 50 soldiers escorted Gavazzi and his party back to St. Lawrence Hall, where an all-night watch was stationed along the hotel's perimeters. He eventually fled to the wharf in a closed cab, crossed the river by boat, and escaped to the United States. According to information found later in Gavazzi's autobiography, the 30-year-old valise containing his very colorful soutane and coat was in the midst of the chaos, handed to someone who promised to forward them to his hotel. Neither were ever seen again. Meanwhile, Mayor Wilson was also hustled away from the scene by a group of soldiers. He was taken home, where guards stood overnight watch. The day after the riot, on Friday, June 10, Gavazzi remained sequestered in Henry Hogan's hotel on St. James Street. There was still, somehow, the question of his two remaining talks. Many came to counsel him and attempt to dissuade him from addressing Montreal anymore for the time being. In the end, Gavazzi finally agreed that it might be best to return to Montreal sometime soon, and that for now he should depart for New York a few days earlier than planned. On June 11th, at 5 o'clock, a heavily guarded Gavazzi stepped out of a side door at St. Lawrence Hall, now carrying his still-injured secretary in his arms. A closed carriage took both of them to the dock, where they caught the steamer ferry Iron Duke for La Prairie. They arrived by train in New York City that very evening. Alessandro Gavazzi never returned to Montreal. And so it was that the newly arrived Cameronians, a regiment which was two-thirds Protestant and one-third Catholic and all under Presbyterian command, had killed and wounded mostly Protestants. Added to this was the fact that, as mentioned before, most people thought the mayor had ordered the firing to begin, and he was Roman Catholic. Neither the incident nor the regiment was to be forgotten or forgiven by Montreal's Protestant community. In the July 15, 1853 edition of Montreal Witness, a reporter still felt angry enough to write that, quote, defenseless Protestants had been massacred by a rabid popish mayor, end quote. Despite fears of reinciting anger, authorities held a coroner's inquest. It sat for some 25 days, with deliberations ending July 11. It was impartially chaired by Monseigneurs Jones and Courcelle. It heard from 106 witnesses and in the end could not supersede its own religious divisions, 19 jurors, 10 Catholic and 9 Protestants. Evidence seemed to point to the notion that the division facing the Protestants, who were still in the process of leaving the church intentionally, fired high. Evidence seemed to point to the notion that the division facing the Protestants who were still in the process of leaving the church intentionally fired high in order to prevent injury. Autopsies also revealed that some people on both sides of the religious divide were killed by small firearms, which excused the military of those incidents. So much chaos. The question which always came back to haunt the inquest, however, was who exactly gave the order to fire upon the crowd. Protestants steadfastly believed that it was the Papist mayor, while Roman Catholics had their own theory, which was articulated by a recent arrival to Montreal, a widowed schoolteacher from Canada West by the name of Margaret Brown Parker. According to her testimony before the coroner's inquest in early July, she was standing between the two divisions to one side of the crowd in Haymarket Square. Mrs. Parker continued by saying that an unidentified man in the crowd gave the order to fire as well as any commander could have. She described him as a common Irishman who wore a blue coat, made in the real old Irish fashion, corduroy moleskin pantaloons that came to his boots, and a homemade straw hat. When she later reproached him for causing trouble, he responded with a smile, "It's 19 years since I took the lousy shilling, but all that time I had not the satisfaction I have this night," referring to the time he was enlisted. A few moments later, she saw him again, this time with two or three others, one of whom said, "It was not him gave the word, it was the Holy Virgin." The issue and tension associated with that unfortunate day's events in the city's history remained present for several years to come, but this was especially pronounced in the weeks following the riot, of course. Clashes between Protestants and Catholics led to church windows being broken and shots were fired in the streets. That said, things here never escalated quite as much as they did in New York City or in Toronto. Again, I'll take time to elaborate on all of that eventually. As for Gavazzi, he never came back to Montreal. He did, however, return to his beloved Italy, defiantly establishing a small Christian church directly across the Tiber from St. Peter's in Rome. His church still stands today. He died in the Eternal City in January of 1889 at the age of 79 and is buried in that city's Protestant cemetery. And now for the story locals have no doubt been waiting for. I'll admit that this part of my script lay empty for a few days as I mulled over how I wanted to present the story. You might have heard about Mary Gallagher before this, and if you have, you've most likely been told that she was a sex worker. It's what you'll be told 75% of the time, including while on the Haunted Montreal Ghosts of Griffintown tour. By the way, I highly recommend taking the tour, and this is in no way a negative commentary on it. I'm just saying that this has become what people consider to be common knowledge, but nowhere in the court documents does it say that she was a sex worker. And again, no shame. We're just talking facts. Was she an alcoholic known by neighbors and local law enforcement for the behavior this condition can produce? Absolutely. Is it possible that she turned a trick or two at some point in her life? Maybe. We don't actually know. What we do know for sure is that her short life was one filled with chaos and debauchery. Mary Gallagher met her friend Susan Kennedy when the two were doing a simultaneous stint in the Slammer. It's unclear when their friendship started, but at the time of the incident, it was in full swing, no pun intended. At this time, Mary had been separated from her husband James for 2 years and often stayed at the apartment Susan shared with her husband at 242 William Street while looking for work as a servant. Susan and Jacob had moved in on May 1st and immediately began pissing off their neighbors. One witness described the couple as dissipated characters that were in the habit of having friends in to see them and carrying on the most disgusting orgies. Note, orgies then, orgies now, not the same word necessarily. Mary met Michael Flanagan at Bolsequil Market on Thursday, June 25th, 1879. The two drank all afternoon before spending the night together in a hotel room. At around 7 in the morning, Mary invited Michael to Susan's home, where they spent the rest of the morning drinking a few bottles of whiskey. Susan's husband, Jacob, didn't feel like drinking with them, so he left soon after Mary and Michael arrived. He sporadically poked his head in to check up on everyone, and at one point, he came home to find his wife in bed with Flanagan. "Shut up," she told him. "We're only talking." Before we get into it, if your children are listening, heads up, we're going to talk about murder in some detail. At noon, Ellen Burke, the tenant living downstairs, heard, quote, "an awful stumble upstairs as if something had fallen. It shook the house and knocked plaster off the ceiling in two places." This was followed with the sound of a person chopping, and the blows were very heavy as they shook the house. The chopping lasted fully 10 minutes. Jacob was a meek, strange-looking man regarded by locals as pathetic. Even the neighborhood's children taunted and bullied him. On the morning of June 26th, after one of these verbal attacks, he was heard saying, "Let me alone. I have trouble enough. There's a woman upstairs with her head cut off." Nobody reacted to this, but did to Susan Kennedy sticking her head outside her back window at 10 p.m. and yelling, "Murder!" Ellen Burke sent her 13-year-old son upstairs to see what was up, and the poor kid arrived to see a scantily clad woman lying on her back on the kitchen floor. Well, most of her body was. Her head and her right hand were in a basin by the stove. When the police arrived, they questioned Jacob and decided to take Susan into custody. Not only did she not resist, protest, or even panic, but she coolly announced that she was hungry and would need a bite before going anywhere. She sat at the table, buttered a piece of bread, and calmly munched away a few feet away from her friend's headless corpse. Michael Flanagan, who lived a few blocks away with his mother, was arrested the next day. A jury of 16 decided that 32-year-old Flanagan seemed intelligent and truthful. He admitted that he had been there at the time of the murder, but was boozy and had ultimately slept through the ordeal. He said that when he left at 2 p.m., Mary was lying on the floor, but her head was still attached to her body. As for Susan's husband, Jacob, the jury concluded that Jacob contradicted himself so much that he was deemed as slightly demented and, quote, "very much afraid of his wife, who seemed to have been a terror to the police as well as anyone who had anything to do with her," end quote. As for said wife, whose age at the time is recorded as either 20 or 26, claimed that a strange man had entered the house and killed Mary. The thing is that she consistently changed the details of her alibi. She was in a drunken stupor and slept through the murder. The man who did it was so good-looking she gave him time to get away, etc., etc. But the evidence found included her blood-encrusted clothing and the murder weapon, an axe which had been hidden in the trunk in her bedroom. It didn't look great. To add to this, she had a violent history, with Constable William Craig testifying that he had arrested her on numerous occasions and that at times she was so violent with drink that it took two men to hold her. Flanagan was absolved, but the jury found Susan Kennedy guilty with a recommendation for mercy. The judge ignored the latter part and sentenced her to hang on December 5, 1879, saying, "You and only you butchered and mutilated your friend on the very spot where you had been carousing up to the moment of the murder." Susan seemed indifferent throughout the whole process. Prime Minister John A. Macdonald later commuted the sentence so that Kennedy served 16 years in jail, dying in 1926. The sensationalism born of this ordeal affected the neighborhood, which, as we have mentioned, already had a bad reputation. So many people gathered to catch a glimpse of the body and spread whatever observations they made and rumors they heard, and then there was the press. Sightings of Mary's ghost began soon after her death, and persisted with some regularity for a few years. Sometimes she was headless, and sometimes not. I'm not sure when it started, but at some point people began to gather at the spot where she was murdered every 7 years, when it is said that she returns for her head. A friend and I actually attended the last ceremony on June 26, 2019. It was one of the most absurd things I've ever witnessed, and I loved it. As people gathered in the oppressive heat, a man in an Australian outback coat began emptying the contents of two bags he had brought onto one of the concrete blocks that loosely outlined the parking lot we were in. He started mixing and serving whiskey Caesars to anyone lining up for a plastic cup. While this is happening, the priest arrived and tied his dog to a tree nearby. The blessing began, but the priest who normally conducted the ceremony was absent, and this man kept forgetting Mary's name, so we'd all have to occasionally chime in with a unified Gallagher. This was happening at rush hour, so a steady and slow stream of cars was passing by, their passengers gawking. Now, in addition to all of this, the priest's dog was whining, barking, and occasionally straight up howling through it all. It was bloody magnificent. People set out lawn chairs to hang out, waiting for her ghost afterwards, but we had dinner plans. And that's the story of Mary Gallagher. I just want to take a quick sec to talk about flooding at the time. We talked about fire, we have to talk about flooding. It happened annually and was a source of worry and strife, in addition to said fire. In January of 1886, a record flood stretched beyond Griffintown and poured 3 meters of water into the Grand Trunk Railway Depot. It washed over 700 businesses, causing more than $2 million in damages, wrecking expensive first-class train cars, Pullmans, etc. The 7 feet of water that poured into Bonaventure Station ruined the offices and workshops there and put 1,500 people out of work. 20,000 barrels of sugar sat underwater at the St. Lawrence Sugar Refinery. I'm mentioning this flood in particular not only because of how disastrous it was, but because now that the rich had been as affected as the poor, this is when people started talking about actually doing something about it. Action wasn't taken immediately, though, as it would be another 2 years before a team of engineers from the Royal Commission were sent to test out a few prevention methods. One of them involved blasting several holes into the river ice miles below the city, hoping it would create a runoff path. This worked as well as the prayer Archbishop Fabre hoped would solve the issue. Again, the next year in 1887, the river suddenly jumped up a few feet, startling residents and causing a stampede. For 5 days, police and priests rode through Griffintown delivering cheese, milks, sugar, and bread to residents. Some streets were inaccessible due to large chunks of ice blocking the way. Then it rained so heavily, some of those boats had to be bailed. A true mess. It was only in 1901 that people thought, hey, let's build a wall. They did. A solid stone one. And Griffintown was finally safe from severe flooding for good. That's all it took, after all that time. I want to make one last point, and it's something we'll get into in other episodes in the future, but while all of this was happening in Griffintown, know that Montreal's golden age was during the 1880s. We were way ahead of Toronto with regards to economy. We were Canada's undisputed metropolis. The office buildings and shops along St. Catherine were impressive, and prosperity was evident above the tracks. I'll bring this contrast up again when we get into the city above the hill later on. Massive shout out to Sharon Doyle Dreider and her book, An Irish Heart. It's been my main source for this season, and all sources will be noted in the show notes, but this one deserves mentioning. You guys, thank you so much for your presence. These are coming out a lot slower than I'd like, but my real estate career must be my focal point right now. That said, I'm so excited to finally be recording this episode because we've now brought Griffintown into the 20th century. That's next time on Histories of Quebec. Now I'm going to share a little bit about myself as I've done in past episodes. This time I'll keep it short, but I'm happy to answer any questions should you have any. On April 12th, 2022, I had my last drink, and the next day I decided to give sobriety a try. Over the last 2 years, I've completed my 12 steps and unpacked the what's and why's of it all. I take it one day at a time, but will presumably be receiving my 2-year chip shortly after April 13th. It's the best decision I've ever made, and one I happily and gratefully wake up and make every single day. It shocked a lot of people I know because I worked in the craft beer industry at the time, and still do for a little while. But it had to happen. If anyone is struggling with addiction, I urge you to reach out for help. Meetings take place every day, several times a day, and within them are people with whom you can relate more than you can even imagine right now. And don't hesitate to reach out to me or anyone else you know who has managed to stop and do the work. We're here for you. Until next time, take care.